If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
You know, earn as much money as you can earn, live on as little of that as possible for a certain time frame, and invest the difference, right, into assets. For me, that was real estate. For a lot of folks, that's the stock market or index funds or whatever.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Travis Watts is a full-time passive investor. He's been investing in real estate since 2009 in multifamily, single family, and vacation rentals. Travis is also the director of investor relations at Ashcroft Capital. He dedicates his time to educating others who are looking to be more hands-off in real estate. Hey, Travis, welcome to the show.
Sam, thrilled to be here. Thanks for the invite.
It's awesome. Glad to have you on. I met you maybe, I think, a year ago at a conference. Yeah, it's great to have you here. I'd love to hear your journey as a passive investor, because you weren't always a passive investor, from what I understand. So kind of if you can give us an idea, the same question I ask every guest: where'd you start? Where are you now? And how'd you get there?
Sure. Yeah. Got started with single family homes, 2009. Did everything very active, very hands-on, very self-managed. And for me, that ended up being a really big mistake. So didn't know what I didn't know, didn't have mentors, didn't have programs, hadn't been attending conferences like where we met back then. Wish I had them. And just didn't really have a big circle to pull from, you know, of different strategies I could utilize, different asset classes, what all this stuff's about. So dove into some house hacking, renting out a spare bedroom. That's really what opened my mind to this idea of passive income and money could potentially roll in that I didn't have to actually work for, so to speak. That led me to do some flips. That got to be very hands-on, as well as vacation rentals. That got to be even more hands-on. And long story short, I was trying to scale that up and I burned myself out about 6 years in that process. So that's where I did finally go back to the education space, the drawing board. I started reading a ton of books, listening to a lot of podcasts, surrounding myself in real estate meetup groups with other like-minded folks. And more importantly, folks 10, 15, 20 years beyond where I was at. That's where I discovered multifamily, apartment syndications, real estate private placements. And I decided for myself, that made a lot more sense. I wasn't a so-called expert in the space. I didn't like managing tenants. I didn't like trying to find properties. I didn't like the competitiveness of, you know, bidding for properties and getting outbid all the time. It was just very frustrating and time-consuming. So I switched over to being a limited partner and partnering up with folks with more of a track record, more experience, doing what they do best and things that they're passionate about. And I wasn't passionate about the business of real estate. I was just passionate about real estate as an asset class. So at the end of the day, I was just looking for cash flow, tax advantages, you know, leverage, a place to park capital outside the stock market. Yeah, that's kind of how the journey goes. So 2009 to 2015 was single family. 2015 to 2020 has been passive investing in multifamily. So that's kind of how the journey's progressed so far.
That's awesome, Travis. I mean, very, very cool. Most people, though, I guess it maybe in that for you, you had to have, though, some capital to do that. Like a lot of people continue to stay as an active investor because they don't necessarily have the reserves to, you know, just go full time passive. So were you working another job? Was there some other form of income coming in? I mean, if you weren't great at being an active investor, which sounds like you did OK, but maybe you weren't great at it. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But okay, so it is fair. Hey, man, there's no shame in being honest. So how did you move from that? Like when you said, all right, great. Well, I've got all this active stuff going. Do you sell it all off, take, you know, harvest some proceeds and then just go all into passive? Or do you have other work going on? Or how did that work?
Yeah, so I kind of used the FIRE movement philosophy, which, by the way, I didn't know about back then. I was just raised by some frugal parents that, you know, things were ingrained in my mindset, you know, spend less than you earn and use coupons and don't buy crap you don't need. I mean, this was just my childhood.
Sure.
But the FIRE movement, anyone who's not familiar, is just a simple concept of, you know, earn as much money as you can earn, live on as little of that as possible for a certain time frame, and invest the difference, right, into assets. For me, that was real estate. For a lot of folks, that's the stock market or index funds or whatever. That was the approach I used. So to answer your question, I absolutely had a full-time job, W-2, more than a full-time job in the oil industry. So I worked 98-hour work weeks consistently, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. That was my schedule for years. And wow. I worked out of state. I worked overseas. I worked in the Middle East. And I did all kinds of things in that industry while trying to scale and balance a real estate portfolio. So this is, you know, hence the burnout. It wasn't just the flips and the vacation rentals. It was, you know, having a few hours per week of spare time and 100% of that used towards that stuff. And it's just at capacity, you know, that's kind of how it went. So that's how I built up capital, is just having an extreme savings rate. It was like 50 to 70% is what I saved of my total income wow. for many, many years. And, you know, as I was turning that over in a good real estate market, I was out in Colorado between Fort Collins and Denver. It's about a 50-mile radius. And I had all my properties up and down the I-25 corridor, for anyone familiar. Yeah, it was the grind. It was the struggle. It was a lot of sacrifice. That's just the approach I took. I don't endorse taking that approach. it was rough and it was brutal. But I always joke, I should have just started a company and sold it for $5 million and been done with the capital side.
Right.
That would have been easier.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, that's kind of how I got rolling. And to the point where I had enough capital, to your point, that I could put it to work passively, have enough income rolling in to cover my lifestyle expenses, so to speak.
Right. That's fascinating. So you invest solely in multifamily now?
About 80% of my total investments are in value add, B-class, multifamily syndications. I've done some C-class stuff. I've done some self-storage, some note lending, ATM machines. I've experimented with other asset classes. But at the end of the day, I'm a cash flow focused investor. Mm-hmm. So if it's something that could potentially give, you know, say a double digit return and cash flow focus, that's something I'm interested in, generally speaking.
Right. Okay. So walk us through that process, you know, because for us as capital raisers, you know, it's always good to get inside the mind of the people who are obviously placing that capital. Like, what are things you look for? Not necessarily what should we look for in general, but what are things that you particularly look for? You say, hey, man, these are the criteria that mm-hmm. I either love, hate your deal. You know, these are things that get me excited on a you know, kind of bottom line up front. Like, yeah. Kind of walk us through that process for you.
Yeah, you know, something that really changed my approach is when I started converting over in 2015 and 2016 to selling off my single family and going into multifamily, I knew enough to be dangerous. I didn't know enough to be effective. So I made some mistakes, as we all do. And I didn't have defined criteria. And this is something I talk about all the time through podcasts, blogs, and all the rest. So I finally got serious. I sat down after reading books, listening to podcasts, and I started thinking, okay, what makes the most sense for me, right? This is highly individual, anybody listening. So it doesn't matter what my criteria is. It's that you define your criteria. And for me, some examples of that would be, as I mentioned, B-class assets, multifamily sector. I like 5-year holds, generally speaking. I mostly don't do fund investing, but sometimes I will, depending on the situation. I like monthly distributions versus quarterly because it's my income. There's just different pieces of criteria that resonate well with me. And I have my reasons for wanting that stuff. So the first thing is, I look for a team or a sponsorship group that aligns with that criteria. Okay, so if I'm sent a deal about a new development in San Francisco or whatever, A class, I'm not interested right off the bat. That's an easy decision. I don't even have to look at the pro forma because I don't care. It's not something I want to do.
Right.
You want to know what states or what submarkets you like and all these kinds of things, you know. So there's really three elements of risk, as you know. There's, you know, the sponsorship team, the market that you're investing in, and then the deal itself. Unfortunately, one of the biggest mistakes I made when I started was having that reversed and upside down. So I was looking way too heavily at the deal and the projections and the pro forma and not considering who the team is and if they can even pull off this business plan at all. And to my surprise, they couldn't in a couple instances. And so as much as I love that deal, you know, it didn't really happen, you know, the business plan. And so we ended up exiting early and not making nearly what we could have made had it been properly executed. So So that's what I do now is I vet teams. I vet operators. You know, I spend a lot of time on the phone with different folks who are active, you know, and asking them about their deals and the markets they're in and their philosophy and their track record. And then I'm getting, you know, put on lists for deals of operators that I resonate with. So that's kind of my approach in a practical sense of kind of how I do it, what I do.
Right. Yeah. That, I'm sure there's not a quantitative way to put this, but what would you say the weighting is for the operator to the market, to the deal itself? Like, is there percentages you could assign to those that you kind of say, hey, this is where I'm thinking?
That's a good question. I would put nearly 50% right to the operator right off the top. And I would say probably split between market and deal 25-25, more or less. And I'll tell you why. There was a deal I invested in early on out in Georgia. You know, the operator was not, they really didn't have the track record or the experience, right?
Right.
It was a pretty heavy value add plan. And they couldn't execute it, but they did buy a great asset in a great market at a great time. And we all made money as LPs. It's just what we thought we were getting involved with a 5 to 7 year plan was an 18 month plan to exit and about, you know, a quarter of what we hoped to achieve overall in terms of overall returns. So a little bit discouraging and disappointing, but just know that, you know, there's weight in investing in the right markets at the right times. And of course the deal itself, what you're paying for it, all that good stuff.
Right. Let's dig into that deal a little bit if we can.
Sure.
So you exited early, 18 months and it was a 7 to 10 year hold. Was that, or was it 5 to 7?
It was about 5 to 7 years. Okay. That was a little bit flexible on their pro forma.
Sure.
But yeah, it was supposed to be a long-term cash flow play. And it was a very much a headache between all the due diligence and then all the hurdles we hit and then having to sell. And it was just a lot of work, even as an LP.
Now that is a lot of work. Those are the ones we learn a lot from, though. I think there's no free education, I don't think, in life. So it sounds like you paid for that one. But when it comes to, you know, that deal, they got into distress early. Whatever, they hit some hurdles they couldn't overcome as the operator,
right?
And then they said, okay, so we've got to punt this.
Basically, yeah, it was just one thing after the next. It started with something minor, and then it was, well, then there's this. Then they suspected there was fraud with a property management company, and then they stopped distributions, and then they figured out it was more of a lawsuit case, and then I mean, just on and on, right? It's like everything that could go wrong went wrong. They had bought a pre-existing entity for the property. Oh, no. So instead of creating their own, they assumed what was there. That had liability built in that they weren't aware of.
Yeah.
There was just all kinds of, you know, some amateur issues, some things out of their control, unfortunately. But overall, it just felt like every month's another roadblock to the point where it's, hey, look, you know, we've got some equity in the deal. We might as well just offload it. We're all going to be profitable. Thank goodness. I can't complain too much.
Right, right.
But it's better to take that now than to do 7 years of this headache.
Well, for sure. And for sure. And for good for you guys for getting out, not only with your shirts on, but, you know, making a little bit along the way. Cause there's, I'm sure in other market conditions, you may not have been so fortunate.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And that's why, again, the operator, the team, the experience is so important, right? Especially if they've gone through previous cycles or they have some sort of, you know, mentor or co-GP that's kind of on the team or some counsel there. That's important. It's really important to vet out the team and to know what their philosophy would be. You know, I always ask the tough questions before I do a deal. You know, what about this? What if that? You know, I like to look at stress tests, sensitivity analysis, you know, tell me if the Fed spikes interest rates to double, you know, what's going to happen? You know, I like to look at all these worst case scenarios. So yeah, that's part of my criteria.
What does someone do who's a newer syndicator or a newer sponsor? Like what's something they can do, you know, for somebody like you, you might be super savvy and just say, hey man, I've got the pick of the litter. I don't really care, you know, how great you are, how great your deal is. I've already got my team picked out. Like what's somebody, somebody who's just starting out now, what can they do to kind of get that street credit, you know,
so
passive investors want to invest with them?
That's a great question. And actually that's a common call that I have almost on a weekly basis or newer operators reaching out to me just because I have so much marketing out there as being a full-time LP. They want to know my thought process, like this question. So, you know, my main thing is you've got to stand out from the crowd, right? It's a very competitive space, number one. You've got key players who have been in the space for decades. So how are you going to compete, right? Why wouldn't I just go to the experienced operator instead of you?
Right.
So personal touch, you know, going above and beyond, doing more than what's expected of you, professionalism. I firmly believe in giving people a shot. I've invested in several student deals with new operators, but I am limited in that space. That's not the majority of what I do.
Sure.
But you know, if they're going to have perhaps a lower minimum investment, you have to make your deal appealing in ways that other operators aren't doing. So if you've got some experienced operators with 100,000 minimum investment, their deals are oversubscribing in 24 hours, these kinds of things, maybe make your minimum investment, you know, 25,000. Maybe if you can, in the underwriting, have a higher cash flow amount, lower your fees a little bit up front in the beginning. You've just got to make it appealing, because apples to apples, I'm not going to invest with a new operator.
Right.
But to that point, I do invest with new operators who do kind of what I'm saying there. And I do want to give people a shot in this space.
Right, right. No, that's great. That's great. When it comes to, so you're a cash flow investor, right? Mm-hmm. You said you prefer monthly distributions. And we've seen some things coming out lately where the syndication models are kind of changing, where it'll be a class A and a class B, right? So your class A might get, and I'm making this up here. So class A might get a 10%, you know, 10% return. You get paid monthly, but you don't participate in the upside. And class B might get an 8% return, or a 6% return, but they participate in the upside, you know, upon sale. So How does that affect how you view those investments? Because I know obviously for you, this is what you live on. So how does that affect you when you go to invest in those deals?
Yeah. So from 2015 through today, cash flows come down, you know, preferred returns have come down, not a ton, but slightly. You know, maybe you used to get, you know, a 9 or 10% cash flow in that class B situation you were referring to. So I've done both, to answer your question. I do both class A and class B shares. Depends on the deal. If I'm working with a very experienced operator that's done this over and over and over again, has a proven track record, and they're buying a deal that's 100% value add, it's a large project, a lot of units, I see some potential there for some equity upside. I'm probably going to do a B class investment on that type of deal. Not talking about any particular operators, just as a disclaimer here.
Sure.
But and then if I see a deal that's maybe an A minus, a B plus, recently renovated, maybe they're going to renovate 40, 50% of the units, it's a smaller size, I'm probably going to do an A class in that instance, just to clip a coupon, so to speak, average out my portfolio cash flow so that every new deal I'm doing isn't, you know, 6 and 7%. I've got a few that are 10, so I'm averaging kind of what I've always gotten historically.
Gotcha. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Very cool. All right. So, hey, Travis, let's jump into the final four here. The first question being, if you were to distill everything you know that you've learned as a passive investor, and you were going to give this advice to an aspiring investor, what would that one piece of advice be?
There's a quote by Neil Strauss, kind of a modern day philosopher. It's learn more and know less. So, you know, when I got started, I felt like I had to know it all, right? I know how to flip. I know how to do a vacation rental. I know how to manage. But the fact is, I just wasn't that good at it, you know, and people were doing it so much better than me. And it was just, you got to let the ego go sometimes and be a lifelong learner. I think, you know, self-education, books, podcasts, mentors, coaching, you know, whatever, that stuff is paramount. Most importantly, in my opinion, has been mentors. And what I mean by anybody can be a mentor, a book can be a mentor, an author, a YouTuber, whatever. But the mentors that have had the largest impact on my life were actually unpaid mentors. They were just folks in my network who were much further along than I was, but I showed a genuine interest in this multifamily stuff and with investing. I was wholeheartedly serious, not just let me pick your brain. It was like, look, man, this is my passion. This is really what I want to do with my life. You're doing it. Can you just please share a few things with me? And so many people are willing to help out that way if you just don't abuse their time and you just take a 15-minute call or something. And so I do a lot of these little Zoom calls and stuff like that. But being able to see someone who's successful share with me, for example, their portfolio or their historical performance or, you know, things, that lessons that they've learned, things that we're talking about on this podcast have made the biggest impact, and a real person who you can say, look, put yourself in my shoes. If you were in this instance, what would you do in this situation? That is so valuable, and that's something you can't get from a book. And so whether you pay for mentorship or coaching or courses or whoever, that's fine. But just know that sometimes you can exchange value too, and maybe working for someone or something for free, or just helping them out in another way can go a long way.
Right. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. And what's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
Oh, man. You know, so I launched a show on YouTube called The Actively Passive Show. And the reason for that is the irony of being a passive investor still has a lot of active elements. And it's to paint the picture of what that looks like. You know, every week, as I mentioned, I'm vetting operators. I'm jumping on calls, having conversations. I'm reading headlines. I'm paying attention to the news. I'm paying attention to the tax proposals and what changes might be coming down the road. So there's an active component to all of this.
Right.
Thankfully, I enjoy it.
Right.
A lot of people don't. But yeah, man, self-education. That's my biggest, you know, thing that I can give back to people or advocate for.
Right. No, that's absolutely key. And when it comes to giving back, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
I give back my time, which is a really interesting concept, because there was certainly that time with the oil field job and the single family that I literally didn't have time. I didn't have time for my own family. I didn't have time to travel. I didn't have time to, you know, vacation. I just didn't have time in my life. I couldn't give you the time of day.
Right.
Now that I've freed up a lot of time through shifting over to a passive investment model and then, of course, not working 100 hours a week anymore, I have a lot more time to give. So what I do is I give back on free 15-minute Q&A calls with everybody and anybody, literally. I spoke with a 17-year-old the other day looking to find out how multifamily works. I spoke with a 70-something-year-old the other day who had heard about syndications on a podcast and wanted to learn more. Everybody in between, accredited, non-accredited, if I can be a resource or just say, hey, this was a book that really helped me, this is a program you might enjoy, I don't know, I'm happy to do that. So that's how I give back primarily.
Right. No, that's great. Now, if listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. For that call I mentioned there, or for a downloadable PDF about understanding real estate private placements in more detail, ashcroftcapital.com/Travis. You can get both of those there. And those are great resources. I'm on YouTube and Bigger Pockets and Instagram, Facebook, and all over. So reach out, and I'm happy to help if I can.
Awesome. Travis, thanks so much for your time. Certainly appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.